is the End User, episode 201 for Thursday, September 17th, The Near Future of Home Theater. Hello and welcome to The End User, the show where we get together and talk about our experience with consumer technology with a bit of news from your perspective. The End User. I'm your host and producer, Chris Barnes, and this week, Taylor is not joining us. He's out. He is traveling in some fashion. Perhaps to the future, I guess we won't know. But with me this week is a special guest, at First Reflect on Twitter, Rob H.
Yes, hello. Thank you so much for inviting me to come onto the show. It's a shame that Taylor couldn't be joining us, but he's getting answers for us from the future, I'm sure.
I'm sure of it.
Inform us when he arrives back, hopefully next week. Yes, I am from the AV Rant podcast. Over there, we say it's your home theater and AV questions answered. And we are a question and answer show focusing on home theater and on audio video. We collect all the questions that come in to our various email addresses and get posted to our Facebook page and that. And we answer them more or less in the order in which they're received. So we go about 2 hours every week just talking home theater and AV and answering questions. It's a lot of fun.
Cool. Yeah, it's a great show you've got there. You guys get really down into the weeds of technical details of all of this home theater and AV equipment. So highly recommended. And I feel like it's a really good sister podcast in some way to Entertainment 2.0, which is on our network. So you guys have some things going on together there. It's cool.
Yes, we've done guest appearances back and forth with Entertainment 2.0 as well. So I said it's about time somehow AV Rant gets represented on the End User. So I'm very happy that this has worked out.
Yeah, glad to have you here. All right, so thanks for joining me this week. It's good to have you on. I'm excited to get to the section about home theater where we can really dig in. That should be fun. Mm-hmm. We'll be talking all about 4K equipment. We'll be talking about some receivers and some TVs. It should be a great time. So,
I'm definitely looking forward to it.
But first, we should get into we are going to do some news, and we always joke every year this happens where 1 week there is this gigantic Apple event, and particularly this past week, boy, that was the mother of all Apple events. They announced a lot of stuff, and we had last week had a lot of coverage about that. But the next week, the tech industry has this like hangover. And this has been true for a few years now, so there's actually not a lot of news. But it's perfect because it'll mean we can get in some more home theater stuff with Rob. So that actually works out pretty well, I think.
Yeah, it's a little bit like the video game industry where there's one gigantic game that comes out, everybody sort of moves out of the way. So everybody knows when Apple's going to be doing their thing. They don't make it a secret as to when it's happening. So I think there's a little bit of that. It's the news cycle game, right? You want to make sure that whatever you're saying is going to get noticed. So
yes,
kind of part the waves there.
Certainly. So let's start off with the top news this week is... Google is releasing their new Android Pay system, and this is interesting. You know, it's almost like passed me by. I almost didn't realize that they had done this until I, started looking for stories in the show notes. So it really, Apple launches Apple Pay to pandemonium in the streets, and I feel like this kind of went under the radar a little bit. And of course, they previously had a product called Google Wallet, which, I'm not sure. Are you iOS or Android or both? Or
I am an Apple user. Up here in Canada where I live, Apple Pay is nary to be found, despite the fact that for quite a while we've had the chip and PIN system and now the tap style credit cards. So we've been using that actually longer than they were being used in the States. And yet when it comes to using NFC on our phones to pay for things, not so much up here. So that's passing us by for the moment.
Yeah. So I had used Google Wallet previously to pay for something at Walgreens, just kind of as an experiment, and it was awful. It was terrible. So I'm sure they've done a lot of work to make this a little bit easier. And from what I've read and from the video and the story we're sharing here, it does seem like it's going to be a lot easier. Previously, I don't know what the security of this is going to be going forward, but it looked pretty seamless from the little demonstration they had. They had like a vending machine where you tap and you know, it'll spit out a soda for you. And my experience previously with Google Wallet was you had to tap the register, and then it would open your phone and be like, okay, what's your PIN?
Oh, gotta, my goodness.
Got to unlock the screen. You go, and you unlock the screen, mm-hmm. and then you it's like, okay, this is your amount. And you're like, yes, yes, I know. And then the register is like debit or credit. And I'm like, oh, my God, this is just, this is not working. And, of course, credit. So that was pretty rough. And from all appearances, this Android Pay system is going to work a little bit better than that. So I'm excited to see, you know, what stores this rolls out into. I'm excited to see, you know, what credit providers it's going to work with. I wonder if some of the banks with, like, personal bank accounts will be able to use this instead of just credit cards. That mm-hmm. has yet to be seen. But it is going to roll out as an update to Google Wallet. So if you had Google Wallet previously and you threw it out the window like I did, it will update itself and will just become Android Pay. So I'm sure one day you'll just notice that it's there. So I checked earlier today that it wasn't an update that I had available to me. So they're rolling it out slowly over time, they're saying. And this is going to be available for...
Sure. Your poor experience is exactly the reason why they decided to change the name and not just call it a different Google thing, yes. but actually make it Android Pay instead of Google Wallet. Although in the story, they mentioned that Google Wallet is not necessarily going away, that name as a product is going to stick around for like private transactions for you to trade money between your friends and family or something like that. A little bit strange, but I guess they get tired of trademarking new things or being creative and yeah. coming up with new names. Is that what it is? I don't know.
Yeah, so that is a little bit weird, but you know how these things go. We always talk about Microsoft and naming things. You know, who knows what the what the companies are thinking about when they roll some of this stuff out. But Android Pay is a pretty good name, so I'm not terribly upset at that.
Yeah, I'm definitely looking forward to the day when the only thing I need to grab when I'm heading out the door is my phone. That's what I want. I want my locks to open from my phone. I want my car to start from my phone. I want to pay with everything with one device. Of course, wow, would you be in trouble if you ever lost that device then? But that really is what I want. I'm tired of having to grab like 5 cards, even though I can tap them all. Like I say up here, it's quite easy. I don't have to have a thumbprint or a PIN or anything. I can just tap a card and it works. But you know, grabbing keys, grabbing car keys, all that. I want it all on one device. So it looks like, yes, Android, yes, Samsung on their own, because, of course, they have their own separate Samsung Pay.
Right, because why not?
and Apple Pay, all of them, they're sort of converging into what seems like a very similar type of system, the same sort of merchants. You know, McDonald's and Starbucks and Walgreens are, like, always the first on board. I don't know if this is going to mean they'll have, like, 3 separate little tap stations, one for
not.
Each one.
No, it
yes,
can't be.
Let's hope they eventually work together and it can be, okay, you just take your phone and now you can pay for things. I think that's what we want.
So I'm going to go another level up here and just say that I don't want to do any of that. I really don't want I just want to like go into a store and grab something and just walk out.
No, you want Minority Report. It just an automatic retina scan every time you go through a door.
I guess I could do that, but I might be arrested.
Yeah, it's not here yet.
Not advisable.
Talk to Taylor about that.
Yeah, so that obviously, if it ever happens, is a long way off. But all this, you know, hand-wringing over exchanging, you know, bills and credit cards, and now it's a phone with a PIN. I feel like we have to have the technology in 2015 for me to just walk out of the store, right? Am I crazy?
and they'll just find you and track you down and say, here's your bill, or just everything
is
free.
Yeah, or something. I don't know. Somebody has to invent that. Whoever invents that is going to have a $1 billion company on their hands.
Or a $0 company if nobody pays for anything.
Well, yeah, that too. So for now, this Android Pay system is rolling out only in physical stores, and they're planning in the future to add it to applications for in-app purchases and that kind of thing. So that's coming up soon. And just, I know that Apple Pay did this as well, and it's really awesome from a security perspective, and that is when you pay with this thing, they obscure your credit card information from the merchant. So the merchant gets a one-time token of some sort to make the transaction happen, and that is how the money gets through, but they never actually receive your credit card. So it's no longer a burden on them to store your credit card information and forward it to some kind of processing to get the transaction to go through. It's no longer on them, and then maybe they, you know, store it indefinitely. Who knows what they do with it? You know, who knows what they do when you swipe a card, right? I'm pretty sure there are some laws around that, but technically speaking, they can take it, and they can use that in the future. So really nice to see that they're basically making it technically impossible for the merchant to be able to take that information from you. So that's really nice to see.
Yeah, the whole security issue around, you know, payments through a phone or whatever. Again, I'm not even exactly sure how our system in Canada works because, like I say, I just tap my cards. There's no PIN to enter. There's no thumbprint or anything like that. And the number that's being transmitted back and forth is not my actual credit card number. It is like a separate number, so they're not seeing the same number as my card. But in terms of if I dropped my card and someone picked it up and just started tapping willy-nilly to buy things, which they could do because they don't have to enter anything to make that work, it's simply a matter of me realizing I dropped my card, calling them and saying, here are all the transactions, calling my credit card company and saying, here are all the transactions that I did not make. And up here, it's pretty simple. They say, okay, those transactions are now all null and void, and that's more or less the end of the story. So whether it's really that necessary to worry about security to this level, I don't even know if that's the case. If the credit card companies can just be willing to say, all right, when a user tells us I didn't make these purchases and we just cancel them all and that's the end of it, it makes it pretty easy from the end user's perspective as to worrying about the security. I don't have to. The credit card company is worrying about it.
Oh, certainly. And that is how it works here, too. You can log in. It's way more liberal with the credit card providers than it is with your bank's credit debit card providers.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, you just call them up and you say, that wasn't me. And they say, okay, you're canceled now. And then they send you a new card. But what this does is it means that you don't even have to have that conversation if the merchant is up to something fishy. Or, you know, you... I think it's less common in Canada to give somebody like a waitress your card, right? Do they come out to the table?
They usually bring the machine to the table, right, and then you do everything. That's the normal way. Yeah.
So then here you give your card to some waitress and they go off into a dark room and swipe it, you know.
Well, there's your problem.
Yeah, who knows what they're doing back there. But this would protect you from that kind of thing.
Right.
And so that's nice. That's nice.
Yeah, sure. Why change the reasonable part of it? Let's worry about the really complicated part instead as a solution to the easy thing that could be changed.
It's a extremely technical and an extremely complicated technical solution to in search of a problem, right?
It could be, yeah.
Yeah. All right. Well, let's stick on the security bandwagon for just a second. I wanted to talk about this. I was debating whether or not to include this in the show because it almost doesn't affect the end user in any way whatsoever. But I'm just really excited about this, and I think that this is kind of a big deal for the web moving forward. And that is Mozilla's Let's Encrypt program that they're doing. They've got something that you can configure on the server that will allow website providers to automatically apply for, renew HTTPS certificates, so TLS certificates. So, you know, in the era of being worried about government agencies looking over the wire, we've kind of realized that we need to take security a little bit more seriously. And, you know, for most people, it's like, okay, you know, I'm not doing anything particularly shady online. But I do think that it's very important to protect your own security and what you're doing online. And I think HTTPS is a huge part of that because it allows somebody, whether it's a governmental agency or somebody else, to not see exactly what's going over the internet. And, you know, they see that something happened, but they can't see inside the envelope, right?
Right. So, yeah, it's really interesting to look at a thing like this from the end user's perspective, because this is the type of thing where if I'm just a user going to a website, it should be seamless. I should really have sort of no idea that this is the way that they're right. handling encryption, that they're essentially going to be running this program instead of having to do much more complicated type of coding. So for me, looking at it as an end user, I go, I don't know. I don't know how they did it, but I see the S on the end of that HTTP, so it gives me some secure feeling that at least I know it should be encrypted. And if it makes it easier for all kinds of websites to do that, where before maybe they wouldn't have just because it's an added cost or extra time to make that work, and now it's much simpler, then that's all I'm really looking for as far as a user, right?
Yeah, exactly right. So that is nail on the head right there. So what this enables people to do, it enables people who provide websites to seamlessly use encryption in a way that doesn't burden them as badly as the current certificate system works. So, for example, you know, on my personal site on Barnesian.com, I've got my server and I've got a certificate on the server, and you know, once every 3 or 4 years, it rolls around. I always forget how to renew it, and you have to do all this crazy nonsense. And what this provides is a way for that provider, like you and me, people who run a website, to do that in a way that is completely automatic. And so you're effectively just removing that barrier from that transaction. And then you get to provide a little bit of privacy to your users that are visiting your site. So I'm not thinking about it in terms of necessarily, you know, like government agencies are after my web traffic, and you know, there's something to be said there. But what this really does is it lowers that barrier to entry for the site providers. So sites like the Digital Media Zone can actually get on board and not, you know, have to like pay for a certificate and not have to go through this ridiculous process of renewing the certificate and all of that. It just happens seamlessly. So I think that's a big win for the security of all end users all around if this actually gets implemented on a lot of those kind of low-hanging fruit unencrypted website kind of places. So potential for a huge win for everyone's security and privacy in that regard. So
Certainly surfing around the web today, I mean, you see a heck of a lot of HTTP with no S on the end of it. It's rare, I would sort of say, other than the places you would expect it. You know, there's places you obviously expect to see encryption, and that's where you do see it. But elsewhere, right. you more or less don't. But we have so many social media things tied in now, people creating user accounts just to leave a comment on anybody's web, all that type of stuff. And that is all personal information. And if you want that to be much more easily protected, then, I mean, you know, you mentioned someone like me. I don't even handle running the AV Rant website. That's all Tom, the actual host and owner of that domain and everything. He's taking care of all of that. We don't have an S on the end, but we do have a system where someone can create a username and leave a comment. So,
yeah,
you know,
that's a good point.
If this makes it easy for someone like us, just get, all right, there you go. And now we don't have to worry that our users' information, we really value our listeners, and we don't have to worry that somehow their private details are going to go out where they don't want them to go out, and it's easy to have it encrypted. I'm all for that. That's yeah, a huge boon.
Exactly right. So that's definitely going to be a good thing to see here. So it's currently in beta. They just issued their very first certificate, and it's going to be coming out of beta, if everything goes well, on November 16th of this year. So
all right.
That'll be cool. So keep your eye on that. You may want to get on that.
Or just look for more S's.
Yes, look for more S's. So, yeah, so before we get into the home theater, I wanted to turn on the afterburners for just a few stories.
Thank you. By special request, in fact. You can't see it on the video. They're below me, but I have specially attached seatbelts to my chair just for this section. I demanded that this happen if I was going to appear. So thank you.
Great. So you are indeed securely fastened.
Absolutely. I've been strapped in for an hour. I'm ready to go.
Okay. Well, we all know that the Apple event happened last week, and we all know that the Apple TV is getting third-party apps from developers, you know, just anyone, not necessarily the Netflixes of the world, but pretty much anyone can submit an app to the App Store on the Apple TV now. So just a couple quick announcements from VLC and Plex that they are planning to add their applications into the Apple TV. So no real details beyond that. So It's good to see that they're thinking about that, and I'm looking forward to seeing how that works.
Yeah, Plex is definitely everywhere, and clearly people were already putting Plex on their old Apple TVs, but it wasn't like an officially supported thing. So it's nice that now it's all easy. Anybody can do it. They just will go to the Apple TV app store. There it is. I mean, VLC, it seems like they've had some of their troubles getting their program to work nicely on all types of different platforms. They're not as ubiquitous as Plex, but this whole thing of apps on the Apple TV, I mean, everybody has been predicting and asking for it for quite a while. It makes perfect sense if we're going to have more home automation, seeing the Apple TV maybe become sort of the hub of your home.
Ooh, a SmartThings app.
All those types of things. This is the way it's going to go forward. So there could be a tremendous number of apps on the Apple TV. I think that is a very real possibility. And it's going to be the larger companies that you already know about who are going to surface, and you'll see them promoted. And this is the start of it. We're seeing it begin.
So very cool. So Facebook has added a new feature to, of course, Facebook.com and their apps, I'm sure, to temporarily change your profile picture and set a basically self-delete date on it. So you'll be able to, you know, a lot of people change their profile pictures to show support for something that's going on. You remember the Twitter green avatars and a couple other things. So you'll be able to basically set up a new profile picture and have it self-destruct after some time. So that's just really clever. That's perfect.
I am happy about this for the simple reason that I will not get an update every time someone changes their profile pic if they use this, because that is one of the sillier things in Facebook. Okay, they updated their status, fine. They made a new post, fine. They posted a new video, all right. But they changed their profile pic? Why do I want an alert about that? I will see it if I go there. So that's good. I'm happy for that for no other reason.
Yeah, alert. This user has changed the picture to the best picture ever taken of themselves.
I am surprised that they did not decide to give you an alert that this profile picture will be transitioning back to what it was before. Knowing Facebook, I thought the idea would be more alerts, not fewer, but happily they went the fewer direction.
So the what was it called? Project Morpheus was the name of this device.
Right.
And that was Sony's play for some kind of virtual reality. And they've switched around the name a little bit, and this is apparently going to be the official name. It's going to be called the PlayStation VR. So extremely creative from Sony.
Shocking. How did they ever think of it? Yeah, PlayStation VR, I have not had eyes on time with any of these VR helmets.
Yeah, me neither,
unfortunately.
Really.
I'm eager to get a look at them for sure. I know that, in fact, when it was Project Morpheus, they were working with Oculus. Oculus has actually reached out to almost all the other VR headset companies out there because they are rightly worried that, okay, they're not going to be able to stop competition, but what we don't want to have happen is have VR look crappy on what ends up being the dominant device, because then that's how everyone's going to judge it. So I'm glad that they're at least saying it's better if all of us do at least a decent job, and then we will not hurt the industry as a whole. But by and large, the reports are that Project Morpheus looked really good. So now it's got an official name, the expectation it's coming out in the first quarter of 2016. So things are chugging along, and it'll be fun. I'm looking forward to virtual reality. I want to hold the two lighted sticks in my hand, have goggles over my glasses and headphones over that headset, because that is the only way to look as cool as possible.
Yeah, I think we're still going to be a few years out from any kind of mass adoption, you know, mass consumer adoption of these kind of things. But we're just getting the early sniffs now, and that's when the technology is really kind of volatile and exciting. So we'll definitely be keeping tabs on that going forward. So Microsoft is slated to have an event on October 6th, and currently it is September 16th. So we'll see what is going to come out at that event. We've got some rumors about Surface Pro 4 and some new phones and some things. So when that event does happen, we will talk about it. But I just wanted to mention that it is indeed coming up. And I'm going to fly off the wing here and mention one last thing, that Microsoft is indeed killing off their Zoom services at long last.
Oh.
So they'll be trying to transition folks over to Groove, and all of the services previously known as Zoom will be sunsetted. So That is an era gone by, and a what I always thought was a technical success from Microsoft, particularly with the Zune HD, but they just couldn't catch on with consumers for whatever reason.
So for end users who were Zune users, will their services be transitioned sort of seamlessly and they'll just have to know that, okay, now it's called Groove, or do they actually have to manually do something to make this transition happen?
Yeah, I would assume, and I don't have an article for this one in the show notes. I'll dig one up and I'll put it in there. But I would assume it's kind of a hard stop. I'm not sure they're... I'm not entirely sure of that, but... I would assume you would have to do something to actually continue doing everything that you wanted to do with your Zune. So, but again,
I'm sure you have been monitoring the news, because anybody who has been a Zune user is usually looking at all Zune related things, because
yes.
It's one of those hanging on by its fingertips for a while now situations.
So I actually don't have one, and I haven't been monitoring it terribly closely, which I know is shocking that I don't monitor the ins and outs of Zune news. But yeah, so if you still use a Zune of some kind, you'll probably want to see what's going on with that.
Well, it seems like I can probably disconnect my my seatbelt now.
Yes.
I can jettison that.
Please do.
I will not be ejected into space, but it is time now for the main feature, I believe.
Yes, so let's get into this. We are here to talk to you, who are, by all rights, an expert in home theater technology. And let's get into the main event here. And I wanted to kind of start out by having you make fun of the TV that I just bought. I mentioned this last week, and I got the Vizio M60C3, which is like the kind of a budget option for 4K. And that was off of Woot, I mentioned, which is kind of crazy, but a little bit cheaper that way. And man, coming from my old Samsung, the Samsung TV I had previously was before the LED era. So going to this, even if I watched content on this TV in like 480p, it would look better than 720p content on my on my old Samsung TV. So I've been fairly impressed with the quality of this thing.
Well, I can lay your fears to rest. There is not a chance I would make fun of anyone for buying this TV. This is a TV I would highly recommend when someone wants to get a large, excellent-looking television for a very reasonable price. You know, you said the thing that matters most, which is you're happy with it. I mean, over on
that's fair.
We get a lot of questions where people are saying, I'm either thinking of buying this, you know, I've gone out, I've heard it, or I've looked at it, and I think it looks or it sounds good. Should I buy it, or am I missing something? It's like, no, you can trust your own eyes and ears. If you like the way something looks and sounds, you're not wrong. That's not how it works. But there are a bunch of big transitions taking place right now on both the audio and the video side. And it's a very interesting time for end users, because last year, all 2014, we sounded like broken records on AV Rant saying, if you can wait, wait. Otherwise, buy something that came out last year. There was almost no products that were actually launched in 2014 that we felt really good about recommending because they were either on the cusp of doing some of these things but wouldn't be able to do them, or they simply cost more than the things that came out in 2013 and didn't do anything new. So what was the point of paying that extra money? It was a bad year last year. But 2015 is a different story. And really what's going on the display side is we have a huge new pile of alphabet soup. And it is something that is going to be very confusing. You know, if people are looking at now the spec rundowns on any websites or just going to the store and seeing the specs that are listed, you're going to be confronted by so many acronyms and initials now and trying to figure out which one of these do I actually care about. Not only that, of course, every brand wants to put their own trademark name on some of these things, so they don't even right. necessarily go by the actual name or initial.
Almost like HDMI CEC was.
Exactly, yes.
That it's like, oh, no, that's AnyNet, yeah.
Yeah, AnyNet, Bravia, Sync, whatever the heck they wanted to call it. So there's really sort of three things going on now. There is, what can the display accept as in terms of a signal? how will it interpret that signal? What will it do inside to that signal? And ultimately, how good is it at displaying the image? And those are three separate things now. So those are sort of all the things you have to look at. So in the case of your Vizio, you know, when we say it's a 4K TV or an Ultra HD TV, those are technically two different things. 4K is supposed to mean exactly 4096 by 2160.
Yeah. But it's not.
That's a cinema. But we've used it interchangeably with Ultra HD. Ultra HD encompasses many things, but one of them is resolution, in which case it's 3840 by 2160. All right, we don't have to worry too much about that. Those two numbers are pretty close. But that's just resolution. At that point, all you've done is added more pixels to the display. Did that make things look a lot better all on its own? Not really. Not unless you moved a lot closer or got a much larger TV, because it's just more pixels. Like, if you get a new handset and it has more pixels than your last handset, it's rare that you notice the difference unless something changed in the color or the brightness or the contrast.
Right.
Those are the things your eye picks up on at this point, because everybody has pixels so small and crammed together so closely. We're not worried about seeing individual pixels anymore. We haven't been for a while.
So what you can kind of think of this as is not, I'm going to get a, you know, brand new 32-inch UHD TV, right?
Right.
But you can think that given the same space and viewing distance that you have, there's a great graph out there of the viewing distance versus resolution.
Yep.
And if you follow along that curve, you can just get a larger TV in the same space. That's kind of how I was looking at it.
Yeah, that's all based on visual acuity, which is, you know, we need about a gap of one arc minute in order to tell that two things are two dots. There has to be a gap between them. And once that gap is smaller than one arc minute, we don't see two separate things anymore. They merge into one. So that is based on degrees, which means it's based on distance. It's, you know, how far apart the actual sensors are in our retinas, and then the distance we can see that difference. So the resolution thing is the least interesting part of all of what's happening in televisions today. The TV that I have, which is a Sony 65-inch X900A from a few years ago, I like to say it is an HD TV that happens to have more pixels. That's what it is, because it doesn't do anything that an HD TV didn't do other than it just happens to have more pixels.
Yeah,
so it's all this other stuff that's interesting.
And that's a pretty good way of looking at it, I find. You know, I went ahead and made the TV upgrade knowing that, A, the content just isn't there yet, and B, all the equipment around it wants nothing to do with that resolution currently. So I kind of knew that going in. And Blu-ray still looks really good on it. So in 1080p, it still looks really nice, on even though it's not taking advantage of the higher resolution. But I don't think that, you know, depending on how long you think you're going to keep the TV, I feel like initially, right now, if you can't get 4K content on it, I'm ambivalent to that. I feel like that's not that big a deal.
Yeah, it's certainly that's what's coming. We know that. We know that we do have several streaming services now that are available that are offering 4K content, but you better have a darn solid internet connection, because it's streaming. And, you know, if you're talking Netflix or Amazon, it's like, a lot of the time, they are not sending you 4K because your internet connection is just ever so slightly below the bandwidth requirements. You're getting 1080p anyway, and your eye probably can't even really tell. As long as the scaler in the TV is doing a good job, you're probably not able to tell the difference between a 1080p stream and a 4K stream.
I'd have to imagine that they, with the adaptive bitrate stuff that they do too, you could absolutely get 4K or UHD, and it could still look terrible because they downed the bitrate, right?
You might be getting a 480p feed, right, coming into your 4K TV over the 4K service. So that's why I actually kind of want people to not worry about 4K or Ultra HD, because that's just a resolution, and that isn't the important thing. What's important is,
that's marketing.
Look good on it? And second, is it going to be able to accept all the new signals that are coming down the pike? So in your case, again, with this Vizio M series, you know, okay, it's a 4K Ultra HD TV, but I would in fact say it's the same as my Sony. It's a little bit more advanced than my Sony because of something I'll mention, which is the things it can accept that my Sony can't accept. But in terms of what it actually shows you it is an HDTV that happens to have more pixels, but right. it's a really good HDTV.
Right.
And one of the reasons it's a really good HDTV is because it has one technology called full array local dimming. That's an acronym that we call FOLD. And what they're doing there is instead of having one set backlight that's always on or little strips of light on one edge or two edges of the TV, which is what we see in a ton of TVs, it actually has a full array of lights behind that LCD panel, and each zone, and there are 32 zones in your Vizio, can be individually dimmed or brightened so that whatever is on whatever image you have, if it's a dark sky but it has one bright object in that sky, then only that bright object has to be illuminated by that zone that happens to correspond to where that object is on the screen.
Right.
That's a big reason why your TV looks good.
If you don't turn it off, which you can do, by the way, in the settings.
You can. Yeah, that's right. So, you know, on the actual display side, we've got that. We've got full array local dimming, which is an important thing. There is edge lit local dimming, but it doesn't work nearly as well.
Yeah.
And so you see that a lot. And then there's completely other display technologies like organic light emitting diode, which is more similar to plasma in that each pixel is individually controlled. So you can almost think of it like having, you know, however many million local dimming zones, because
right.
that's basically what's
it's every single
there.
Pixel.
So there's the two things to worry about, right? There's how it actually looks, and then there's the side of what can it accept. And that's where we're actually looking more at the HDMI connection on the thing. If you're looking through that spec sheet, it's important to look for two things now. You want to see HDMI 2.0A, and you want to see HDCP 2.2. And the reason is the HDCP 2.2 is actually a really annoying thing, because 4K sources now and in the future, we're talking about things that are outside of the actual apps that are built into your TV. But anything that you're going to be connecting externally to the TV, they want copy protection. They are not giving up on this idea of copy protection, because
Boo.
for some reason they think the way people copy discs is by taking the HDMI connection and putting it into a real-time recorder and spending 2 hours recording the video that way. I've never seen anyone do it, but they're worried about it still.
That's how I get my UHD content onto my VHS tapes, you see.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So those two things are important. HDMI 2.0A differs from HDMI 2.0, which we had on a bunch of TVs last year, in that it can now accept the new thing, which actually does make a difference, the new part of the signal that does make a difference where the resolution doesn't really, which is high dynamic range. High dynamic range is the thing that's going to sell TVs, in my opinion. If you go in and you look at a 1080p TV next to a 4K TV and they don't do anything different other than one has more pixels, there's not a compelling reason to buy it. Not really. But high dynamic range is something different. So we've basically now established two standards for high dynamic range in terms of the actual signal. There are other ones out there that are not dead yet, but these are the two that are actually getting used and seem like they will survive. One of them is an open standard that was created by SMPTE, the Society of Motion Picture and Television Engineers. There's no licensing fees or royalties attached to this, and it's called HDR10. The other one was created by Dolby, and they call it Dolby Vision. So what's interesting is Dolby Vision can be quite easily converted into HDR10. So the CEA, the Consumer Electronics Association, they came out and said, we have now created a definition of what is a high dynamic range display. It's an interesting definition because all it defines is what that TV must be able to accept and understand as a signal. It doesn't tell you how good it is at displaying it. That's up to the manufacturer.
Right.
But in order to call it an HDR, a high dynamic range display, and to have the logo, which the CEA is presently creating, a logo so they will be able to stamp the letters HDR onto the outside of the box, is it has to accept the SMPTE version. It has to accept HDR10. That's what it is. Dolby Vision is optional. So that's up to the player, basically, to decide. The player might have to be able to accept Dolby Vision and turn it into HDR10, because that's all the TV has to be able to understand to call it HDR.
Right, it really has to be all the way up and down the kind of home theater stack that you have, right? Because that was my problem is I now have an old, so I've got a home theater PC going into a receiver, and the receiver going into the TV and going out a 5.1 set of speakers. So in that case, every chain in the link or every, sorry,
link in
the other way. Yeah. Every link in the chain has to have this standard baked into it for you to actually take advantage of that.
Yeah. Well, this is another one that's confusing for end users, because in the case of the chain, all that matters is the connection. Right? Your AV receiver doesn't have to understand HDR. It doesn't have to have an
right.
HDR.
It just has to pass it along.
It just has to have the HDMI connection and the copy protection. So that's why there's this delineation. If you understand the delineation between connection, understanding the signal, and displaying the signal, and you can think of those things as almost three separate things that you're looking for, then those are the important things. The display needs to have all three, but everything else in the signal chain only needs the first part. It only needs the connection, because it doesn't have to do any decoding. It just needs to pass it along to the TV. So that HDMI 2.0a, that HDCP 2.2, that's important in the source. That's important in the receiver that sits between the source and the display. And of course, it's important in the display, the end device.
Right.
But you can do an end around, right? If you have a source that has HDCP 2.2 and you have a display that has HDCP 2.2, but your AV receiver does not, you can connect the two directly and then have a second audio connection to go to the AV receiver, because all you're really worried about the AV receiver decoding is the audio, not the video. So there are solutions for that, and that's exactly what's going to be happening with the first Ultra HD Blu-ray players. A lot of them are going to have two HDMI outputs, one of them with HDCP 2.2, one of them without, that is basically only for audio.
Right, that makes a lot of sense. I still would like to upgrade my receiver, probably. That's...
Yeah, well, we're going to be getting into for sure, into AV receivers. But just before we do, I wanted to mention one more thing about the whole high dynamic range thing, because I want to warn people that a lot of the end user listeners are probably can remember back to when we had HD compatible displays. They weren't HD TVs. They couldn't call them HD TVs because they didn't have an HD tuner. They might not have even had full HD resolution. They just called it HD compatible because it could accept an HD TV signal from an external device. And we had that horrible designation. We have the same thing happening with HDR. We have HDR compatible displays that are not necessarily high dynamic range. They can take the signal, they can show you an image, but the actual image you see is not necessarily high dynamic range because they're missing the last component I talked about, which is actually making it look good. So I have to give some praise to Samsung, but then at the same time, I have to slap them on the back of their wrist and say, you darn bastards for doing things the way you did, because they delineated in their lineup their TVs. They had UHD TVs, which were just HD TVs that happened to have more pixels. And then they had SUHD TVs. And the SUHD TVs are all HDR compatible. And Samsung actually has the best TV that you can go out and buy right this second, which is their JS9500 series. That's out there right now. You can get a 65-inch for about $5,000. Pretty expensive, but it is a great TV. But there are a bunch of lower model numbers that are designated as SUHD, and as you go down, they get worse and worse at actually showing you the HDR, the high dynamic range content. When you get down to the 7000 series, it's an 8-bit panel, which means it can't show you more colors than your old TV could, and it can't really show you more brightness. All it does when it gets a high dynamic range signal is it turns its backlight up to maximum and says, there you go. That's our version of high dynamic range, because now it's brighter. But the blacks got worse too. So you didn't get better contrast. You just got a way scorchingly bright image. That's not HDR, but it's HDR compatible.
And, it looks better on a show floor, right? So...
Exactly.
Yeah, you know, the first thing I got my new TV and I was all excited. You know, I unpacked it and I put it up on the TV stand by myself, I might add, which was probably dangerous. But I put on the Blu-ray of Serenity, and I'm like, damn it, it looks like a soap opera. And I knew exactly what that was. You go in and you I forget what Vizio happens to call it, but it's that sports mode that is on.
True Motion? Is that they call it True? Is that them? That might be LG. I can't remember.
But so I went into the settings and turned all of that off, and then it looked normal again. And it's like, why do you turn these things on? It looks ridiculous. And of course, the backlight is at 100% and everything's blown out. It's crazy looking. So I had to kind of get in there and tamp that down a little bit.
Yeah. Again, moving into these new standards with HDR, it's interesting on the pro side because the calibrators that used to come in and calibrate your HDTV, Calman software is working very hard. They have new software. They even have a new sensor that people can buy that can measure a full high dynamic range signal.
Yeah, I've seen that.
But there's no way to make it activate the HDR mode in your television because they don't have the test pattern generators to make that happen yet. And laptops don't have HDCP 2.2 4K compatible HDMI connections yet. So they can't really take a laptop out to the field and make the TV go into HDR mode because the test patterns don't exist yet. So we definitely are still in this transition in order for someone to calibrate their TV to the new expanded standards, more colors, much more range of brightness. We are still waiting a bit. But the good news is you could buy something right this second, which is why it's not 2014 situation anymore.
Right.
But for the majority of us, we probably still want to wait another year for prices to come down and for some of this stuff to finally get completely sorted out.
Right. So that makes a lot of sense. It is for the average person, it is really a difficult field to navigate, isn't it?
That is the big problem. I mean, we like it for AV Rant because it generates a lot of questions and keeps our show going for people who care. But the big downside of it is most people aren't going to care enough to even bother asking. And something like Samsung's SUHD initiative, it's great marketing because they're telling you, hey, buy one that says SUHD and it'll do all this stuff. And it's kind of true, but only the very top model does it well.
And nobody says, well, what's the S?
Yeah, Samsung, I guess.
It must just be Samsung HD, I guess.
So it is one of these cases where they have not made things easy for the end user in terms of knowing what will actually look good, knowing what's actually worth spending the money on. It's a case where we are going to have to be careful because this whole HDR compatible thing that they've allowed has created a quagmire where we're going to have a lot of displays that can, they have the connection, they can understand the signal, but they just don't make it look very good. And that's going to make a lot of people disappointed or feel like they wasted their money. And that's going to be a real shame if that happens. So honestly, I'm waiting for LG's OLED screens to just come down in price. Right now, they're about $7,000.
It's better than it used to be.
Yeah, that's right.
You remember
the worry I have there?
There was some event that Sony threw some years ago now where they said, behold, the first OLED television, and it was like 11 or 12 inches across, and it was like $10,000.
For 11 inches.
We've come a long way.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, and Panasonic is entering the OLED market by buying panels from LG, but then using their own software. And the Chinese companies are coming into it too. Hisense actually announced a TV that has very similar specs to Samsung's JS9500 series, but it's $3,000 instead of $5,000. So it's coming. It's there. But this is something for end users to be aware of, which is part of the reason I wanted to come on the show, because if you're looking for, okay, I've got the HDMI connection, I've got something that understands HDR10 and it has the logo, but the last part is the important part, which is how well does it make all of that stuff look? And that's where all of those things that we talked about come into play.
Yeah, and you brought up a good point earlier in that if it looks okay to you, then don't worry about it.
Exactly. Right. Yes. If you are happy, then life is good on we go.
We can talk about it, and I like, you know, getting all of the information and all of that kind of thing. But if you're perfectly happy with how your TV looks, you know, maybe you don't even get a new TV, right?
Yeah, that could definitely be the case. And like we're saying, you know, all of this stuff is expensive right now because it is. Yeah. Yes, you can finally get it. That's one thing. Last year, you couldn't even get it. So at least you can get it, but you're going to pay through the nose to get it right now. So if I see a stratification right now, there's no point in getting something that goes halfway. I don't see any point in buying an SUHD TV that has the connection and accepts the signal, but doesn't display it very well. What's the point of spending extra money for that? You might as well either spend the extra money to do it right or do what you did, go get a Vizio, because they're looking really good and they're not worrying about the high dynamic range part of it. They're just like, all right, we don't do that part of it. Let's not worry about it. Let's make everything else look really good.
Because they're down on the HDMI 2.0 and not the 2.0A.
A. That's right.
Yeah.
But they have the HDCP 2.2,
right,
which my older Sony does not. So you can still connect an Ultra HD Blu-ray player to,
exactly,
it, and you'll get a picture, yeah, instead of a black screen. That's a nice feature.
That was the one thing I made sure was the case before getting it, was that
yeah,
it had HDCP 2.2.
That's right.
And, you know, the HDR, okay, that I'm not too worried about it. But definitely, and honestly, like I mentioned earlier, even for now, you know, it's like, okay, well, those Blu-rays don't exist yet. So as long as it has the capability to do that down the road, then that's fine.
That's right, yeah. So you were saying the other part of your system is the thing that sits in the middle, your AV receiver, and yours right now does not have HDCP 2.2.
No.
And it's not going to be able to pass it along. It would have to be bypassed if you were to keep it. And that's a pretty big deal. Again, 2014, horrible year to buy a brand new AV receiver.
Yeah.
Onkyo really messed people up, because they were touting that they had HDCP 2.2. And they did. They weren't lying about that. They were kind of the only ones, and their sister company, Integra. But the issue was they were using an HDMI 1.4 connection with an HDMI 1.4 bandwidth limit, and they stuck an additional chip on there to make it HDCP 2.2 compatible. So now we have an issue where you could plug in technically a 4K source that had copy protection. It would make its way through, but if you plugged in an HDR source, it wouldn't make it through because of a lack of bandwidth, as opposed to a lack of copy protection.
Oh,
what a horrible situation. And everyone,
ouch,
else, all the other brands last year, strangely, they had the maximum bandwidth, but they didn't have the copy protection. So, okay, if something out there didn't use the copy protection system, the signal would make it through. But if it does, it wouldn't. So horrible year to buy an AV receiver last year. We were begging everyone not to buy a new one, to buy a unit from 2013 and save some money. But
yeah,
things have changed.
Even a used one or something like that. You could,
exactly, yeah,
get them for cheap.
Yeah.
Actually, the receiver that I have right now was, you know, it does 5.1 and it does 1080p. And I was like, oh, that's all I need. And it was $150, you know. It's, and, of course, now I'm in the situation. And, of course, receivers that could do more than that weren't around when I bought it, however many
that's
years
right
ago that was. So
yeah.
So that's about all I could do at the time. And, you know, the fact that you can get a receiver for $150 that does anything,
mm-hmm,
is frankly astonishing.
Yeah, it's an interesting market in AV receivers, and it's finally a good time to buy an AV receiver. What's interesting in the year 2015 is that Denon and Marantz, which are a separate sister company, they're both part of D&M Group, D&M Holdings, they're killing this year. They've done a terrific job with their lineups from top to bottom. And sometimes it's funny because people say, oh, I've been a Yamaha fan for years, I've been a Pioneer fan for years, you know, whatever brand, I've been an Onkyo fan for years. I don't necessarily want to buy a Denon or Marantz because I'm loyal to some other brand, or I just don't want to get the receiver that everybody else is getting. But Denon and Marantz have just knocked it out of the park in 2015. Everybody will catch up next year. I'm not worried about that. But right now, it's not so much the video side that we've just been talking about. Everybody has gotten on board there. All the brands of AV receivers have HDMI 2.0 A ports with HDCP 2.2. It's not really a worry on the video side. So it wasn't just the video side in AV receivers, it's the audio side. We have new changes there as well. We have this new thing we're calling immersive audio now. So we went from stereo to surround sound, and now we're into immersive audio, which, as you might guess, is putting speakers overhead, putting them above you, or at least elevated.
Right.
And so there's more to it than just that, because a lot of people are saying, I don't need more speakers, and how am I going to put them above me anyway? And I'll mention a solution for that towards the end, but there's more to it than that. It's that it's an entirely new way of recording and mixing and mastering audio. So in the past, the movie makers or the music makers would take a particular sound and they would decide which speakers would play that sound. So they had their standard setups. You had a stereo pair, or you had five,
yep,
speakers, or you had seven speakers.
So I've actually, you know, I went to school for audio engineering, and
mm-hmm,
we had a 5.1 setup, and we would mix audio in 5.1. It's an interesting, it's a whole nother beast than mixing,
yeah,
for stereo. It was a very interesting experience.
Yeah, and you know, each sound was called a stem, right? And you would decide, is that stem going to be played out of one particular speaker or out of several? So it was kind of more of a diffuse sound, or would it pan between separate speakers? But it was all this almost one-to-one relationship of sound right. to speaker. And because of that, everyone had to essentially have a standardized speaker setup. If you were going to hear things properly, you needed to position your speakers in your room or around your mixing console in the standardized setup for where those five speakers go. Otherwise, they wouldn't quite come from the right direction in the room. But now in immersive audio, it's a different thing. They're calling it object-based audio, where instead of having one sound come out of one speaker, it's just a sound, and you decide where in three-dimensional space you want that sound to come from. That's all the mixer has to decide. They don't have to worry about how many speakers or where they are. And it's up to a device inside of the playback machine called a renderer to take the information, because there's metadata attached to the sound that says, here's the 3D location in space where it's supposed to come from. And it says, well, you told me how many speakers you have. You told me where you put them. Now, given that information and where I know the sound is supposed to come from, how do I jigger the sound coming out of however many speakers to make it seem like it came from the correct location? That's immersive audio. And that's a very new thing. And it's very cool because it means movie makers will be able to create one soundtrack that can be played back through any system, theoretically, as long as we all get on board with immersive audio decoders.
Right. So you could have a, you could have any amount of speakers whatsoever, and it would be able to just figure it out. That's yep, exactly. That's a really neat idea.
You know, DTS, of course, there's Dolby and DTS, and things haven't right. changed. There's still a Dolby version that they call Atmos and a DTS version that they just call X. So it's just DTS X. And DTS made their system sound extremely flexible in their marketing. They said, it doesn't matter where you put your speakers, as long as you have sort of a vague hemispherical shape in your imagination and you have speakers somewhere dotted around that hemispherical shape, we'll make it work. But of course, in reality, it doesn't really work that way, because yeah, so they, how the heck does your receiver know where they are?
Right. They made all the marketing, and then they went back to the product team and said, okay, you can do this, right? And they're like, well, I don't know.
Well, the renderer might be able to do it, but there's a key piece of information missing, which is where are the speakers? So Dolby's solution to that was the one that makes sense, which is they defined 34 possible speaker locations. They gave them angles and elevations. And they said, you put a speaker in some of these 34 locations, you give them a name, and now your AV receiver knows where your speakers are. And DTS has essentially just piggybacked on that and said, yeah, we use those too. So that's kind of how it went. And
so,
of course,
yeah, that's a good idea.
Yeah, in consumer level gear, we don't have all 34 of those positions available to right. us. We tend to have somewhere around 9 around us, or maybe 10 around us in sort of a vague circle, and then as many as maybe 10 overhead. So maybe there's like 20 positions you could possibly choose, which is still pretty darn good when you're talking about receivers that cost well under $1,000, some as cheap as about $500. So those exist now, and that's what's really nice. And what the reason I said Denon and Marantz are really killing it is because for 2015, the entire line of Denon and Marantz AV receivers, other than the ones that only do 5 speakers, anything that can do 7 speakers or more, because there's ones that do as many as 13, theoretically, they all, first of all, have HDCP 2.2 with HDMI 2.0A connections, and they have both DTS:X and Dolby Atmos. They're ready to go. They've got it all built in there. All the other brands have some limitations. Pioneer, they have not officially said they're supporting DTS:X at all this year. That we're waiting to see if that happens at all. Yamaha has both of those new formats, but only in their
Eventually,
but not necessarily this year.
Yeah, not this year. Right.
So, you know, looking at it from the perspective of I want to go out and buy an AV receiver soon.
Yeah.
It's very easy if you stick to Denon and Marantz. You don't have to worry. All the other brands, you better be kind of careful because, you know, Yamaha, their top 3 models, okay, they've got it. But as soon as you get down to the A850, the fourth most expensive model, it doesn't have DTS:X. It has Dolby Atmos, but it doesn't have DTS:X. So because we were getting so many questions, I actually wrote a couple of articles that I posted on avrant.com, and I've been sending people those links all the time when they're saying, what receiver should I buy? Because, you know, there are the people who are looking for bang for buck, and they're going to be looking at a 7-speaker model, but they want to support all these new things so that when the signals arrive, you don't end up with a situation where you're not able to play back the signal, just like we were worried about with televisions. So it's the same thing on the audio side, and we want to make sure the video makes it through and the audio can be decoded, and you're pretty darn safe doing that. If you want to go the whole hog and actually get really immersive audio, I'd recommend having at least 9 speakers, which is a lot. There's no bones about it. But in order to get that real sense of sound coming from all around you and above you, it's hard to do with even 7 speakers. You're either going to have a gap behind you or a gap above you somewhere. But if you can get 9 speakers, and even better, 11, of course. But if you can get 9, you can get a pretty good darn hemisphere of sound all around you.
Sure. And then the ultimate irony I've always found, you know, I have a 5-1 system, and it's like we're living in an apartment. So, you have the little satellite speakers, and it's like, okay, that's good enough for now, right? That's fine. But the ultimate irony in all of these systems is that, you know, you may have 34 speakers around you, but ultimately you have 2 ears.
Yes.
So if you have, if you've ever heard of any of those 3D recordings that they make?
They call them binaural recordings.
Yes.
And they actually take a dummy head, or even sometimes
exactly.
a real live person's head.
And they stick a microphone in it.
in their ears. They put the microphones in their ears.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because, you know, the way we manage to detect 3-dimensional sound, because we detect that there are sounds in front of us, behind us, beside us, above us. We do that somehow with only 2 ears, and it's not all just triangulation. You know, it's not all just the difference between our 2 ears, because you would have to cock your head and angle it down in order to make that work. And we know that we don't have to do that just to tell a sound is coming from above us. So that's called a head related transfer function. That's the fancy name for sound is not just going in a straight line from sound source into our ear holes. We have this whole fleshy part of our ear outside. Yeah. We have a head dividing our 2 ears. We have shoulders just very slightly below our ears. Sound is reflecting off of all those things. And over the course of our life, our brain learns how to interpret all those reflections to pinpoint where the sound came from. So we use that. And when you put microphones actually inside ear canals and record things that way, it's reversing that process. And it works really well. So DTS has attempted to take a DTS-X recording and allow you to play it back through headphones or in-ear monitors to recreate that. So they're calling that DTS Headphone-X.
That kind of makes sense. I mean, there's no reason you couldn't do that now that you've kind of abstracted away the technology is not like the set of speakers. You have all of this metadata associated with a recording, and you know where it's supposed to be coming from. There's no reason you couldn't now recreate that in headphones, I suppose. That's neat.
Yeah, that's exactly what they're trying to do. The only problem is, of course, it has to be a universal head-related transfer function that they're using. They usually give like 3 different settings for different types of headphones, because, of course, the sound is different if it's an over-the-ear versus an on-ear versus an in-ear headphone.
Yeah.
That changes how the sound will actually reach your eardrum. So they give 3 different settings, but it's sort of a general thing. It's basically based on a dummy head. And that doesn't always work perfectly. In fact, the thing that's most difficult to make a headphone sound like is that the speakers are in front of you, that the sound source is in front of you. That's really hard to do.
Well, because they're not.
Yeah, because they're not, and because our brain is very keenly tuned to our particular head and shoulders and ears. And mine are not identical to yours. And our brain uses some very amazingly small differences to make that determination. We're pretty good at tricking ourselves in thinking things are coming from behind or above. So it works pretty well. And getting back to the VR thing we talked about at the top of the show, this is going to be a huge part of VR, because if we can make sounds in headphones, you've got the goggles on, you got headphones on, and now you can make sounds seem like they're coming from any direction around you really convincingly. That's as much as the visuals, in my mind.
Oh, totally.
Otherwise, you have that dissonance.
Yeah, I mean, having the thing you just described with a VR setup where you've got some faked-out surround sound headphones and you're in, like, a flight sim or something like that, that could be just incredible.
yeah. And when the sound doesn't come across as convincingly as the visual, your brain's going to pick up on that.
It says, I know what's happening here. And it's the same thing. That's why some people have reported getting sick from using their because something's just wrong, and you may not know what it is, and it'll just make you nauseous or something.
And of course, object audio is the only thing that makes sense in a VR setup, because it is dependent on not just the visuals, but the direction of your head, right? That data has to be accounted for, because if a sound source is a stationary sound source, it changes as I turn my head. My experience of that sound changes as I move my head. So an object-based sound that says, here's where it's located in three-dimensional space, now we can calculate based on your own head movement how it sounds to your ears. That's huge, and that's a big part of it. So object-based audio is unquestionably the future.
Yeah.
And it makes so much sense to get an AV receiver. Yeah. That supports it. And that's what we have now. And that's great. We didn't have it last year.
Yeah, neat. That's definitely a positive thing going forward. That's going to open all kinds of home theater setup options for people that want to take them. And, you know, like, some people are going to be happy with a soundbar or something, and that's fine.
Yeah.
But for people who want 34 speakers or whatever the maximum ends up being, then that's A-okay too.
Well, there's a cool thing, because Yamaha has announced a sound projector. They like to delineate between a sound projector and a sound bar, because a sound projector is significantly more advanced than a sound bar, even though physically they look similar. But they have a sound projector that simulates 9 speakers. So they're doing it. It decodes Dolby Atmos. It decodes DTS:X. So it's kind of cool. It's about $1,700. So it's not like you're getting away from the price of doing it, but you're getting away from the complication of the setup, because now it is literally one bar that you put below or above your TV. There is a setup microphone that you put in your listening position, and it for realsies reflects sound off of the surfaces in your room to simulate those 7 speakers around you and 2 overhead. And it does a pretty good job.
I assume they have to do some kind of tuning step where it records itself making noise for some time.
That's exactly it. Yeah, that's what you get. The microphone, you put it on a tripod, you put that in your seat. It plays a bunch of chirps and test tones and sweeps and stuff like that.
Right.
And it calibrates itself. But it for real is reflecting sound off of your ceiling, off of
really
your walls,
neat.
Off the back wall. It's very cool.
All right. Well, I think we're just about coming to a close on our home theater discussion. We've covered quite a few things there, and just kind of wandering through the various standards and binaural audio. So
yeah, it's a really fun time. That's what's exciting about it, because we've known this stuff is kind of coming. We were tracking it last year,
but it
and
wasn't
now
real
it's actually,
yet.
It's actually kind of here. You can actually buy stuff even at somewhat affordable prices, and that's very cool.
Yeah. So we've got a very interesting 2 or 3 years ahead of us in home theater technology, don't we?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, what's really nice is that the standards are settling now. We're not that was a big concern, because we didn't know what it was going to be. There are competing standards. They're kind of still out there, but they're just falling by the wayside naturally, as happens in the market. So now that we know, it's more a matter of just a greater number of products supporting it, and of course the price is coming down as a result. But for the end user, knowing the features that you're looking for, if you at least know, I got to have the correct HDMI connection. I want high dynamic range, so I'm looking for that. I want it to look good, so I'm looking for full array local dimming and 10-bit panels and things like that. And on the audio side, I'm looking for immersive audio support. If you know those are the things I want, then you can find the products at the correct prices once they become available. And that's what's happening over the next few years. And then we're on to 8K, because they're already setting up for that.
Oh, yeah. Josh from Entertainment 2.0 that we mentioned earlier was at CES, and I think he was talking at some point about seeing an 8K display of some sort, and just thinking that was completely you could put your face up against it and you wouldn't be able to see any pixels, right?
It's getting there. Yeah, I mean, Sharp actually just announced, it was either today or yesterday, they're going to be selling an 85-inch 8K display. This is in Japan, because Sharp, actually, the name has been bought up now by, was it Hisense? I think Hisense is the one who bought the Sharp America brand. But in Japan, Sharp is still going pretty strong. So they're going to be selling one in October. If you got $130,000 lying around for an 85-inch TV, and you have a source that can send out 4 4K HDMI connections simultaneously to actually create the image, off you go. You're ready. I'm not quite there yet. It'll be a few years.
Yeah, I think I'll need to open a new investment account and let that, you know, I'm going to do that instead of retire, basically. So we talked a little bit about the UHD Blu-ray standard, and that was ratified relatively recently. I forget exactly when it was. Do we have a sense of exactly when that stuff is coming to market, like actual products?
Yeah, we know the first one, thanks to the IFA show that took place in Berlin.
Right, of course.
Samsung officially announced that they will have, like they were with Blu-ray, they had the first player on the market. The first Blu-ray player was a Samsung, and it cost $1,000. They have an official Ultra HD Blu-ray player. It will cost about $500, and it will be here in the first quarter of 2016, is what they're saying. So we don't have an exact launch date yet. It is not hitting the Christmas time mark that they were hoping to hit. It will be early 2016, but it is done. And yeah, like I was saying, a lot of these standards, thanks to that, it's pretty clear now what the standards are going to be going forward. There are these other ones that are optional, but they basically have to be convertible into the mandatory standards, because otherwise there's going to be a bunch of stuff that doesn't support it. So it's nice to at least see that. You can feel pretty confident that if you buy something that supports the Ultra HD Blu-ray standard, you're going to be good to go for a long time now.
Cool. Well, I'm looking forward to that. I'm looking forward to upgrading my receiver. And I've been told, although I can't test it, that the graphics card on my home theater PC does indeed support 4K output. So
yep.
I don't know if that's actually true, but it says it in the manual. But you know how these things are.
Yeah, again, if it's just the resolution and you're maybe not worried about the frame rate, and you're certainly not worried about high dynamic range or our wider range of colors, if it's just a resolution bump, then yeah, because HDMI 1.4 could do that. That was no problem. It was all these other things.
Yeah. So anyway, I've got a eventful few years in the home theater coming up ahead, I guess, is the idea there. So, we'll start to kind of wrap up here shortly, but you mentioned that you also use Windows Media Center, which I've used for quite some time now. What do you use it for? You don't use it for live TV, but you use it for some other things.
Yeah, that's right. In my case, it's really just a Blu-ray server that okay. I'm using my home theater PC for. I could say that I occasionally play a Flash-based game or surf the web on my TV through it. That is true, but it's really there to be a Blu-ray server in my case. Here in Canada, we never had cable card. That just never occurred. So I couldn't use it as a cable TV tuner. Of course, we have many fewer over-the-air broadcast stations in Canada, so using over-the-air TV is okay, but there's not as much incentive to do it because we just don't pull in as many channels.
We probably get about 30 channels over the air here or so.
Okay, we get 9.
Yeah. But most of them are garbage. It's like...
there's that too.
You get the like 4 or 5 major broadcasting networks, and like Fox, CBS, Univision is a good one for watching soccer, and a couple PBS and a couple others. But beyond that, there's a bunch of garbage too, and it's constantly like floating through your body. I always thought that was a weird thought that there's like
it's
at any point
light.
In time there's like 30 channels encoded in radiation floating around my body, you know, in 1080i for free in the air. It's kind of a weird idea.
Yeah, it's all just part of the electromagnetic spectrum. So yeah. It's all just light. That's all it is.
Yeah, exactly. Okay, well, I wanted to wrap up with one more story, and this kind of ties into our 4K discussion tonight, and that is that NASA has just announced that they're going to be launching their NASA TV in 4K, and that's going to happen on November 1st, 2015. So, again, I don't know. They've got their web footage, their website that has all of the NASA TV footage. I'm not sure if they're... I don't think they're planning to put that in like a TV channel or anything like that, but they're gonna be launching some 4K content on NASA TV on the web. So, again, I think your internet bandwidth may be hurting because of that. But if you've got the bandwidth to stream it, I mean, watching 4K that was shot from the International Space Station or something like that could be truly remarkable.
This is one of those things where any sort of space-based, fictional shows. Yeah. I mean, they are very impressive when you get a huge image, like an IMAX presentation or something like that. At which point you do want the higher resolution, even if it's just for the resolution's sake, it becomes a big deal. when you're blowing the image up that huge. Yeah. When you're watching it on your portable device or on your laptop, I'm not really sure that 4K resolution is going to be that big of a deal or that amazing to look at. But what's interesting is that pretty much all the 4K cameras that have ever been out there, certainly anything that's a modern 4K camera, they don't necessarily tout this aspect of it, but almost all of them can capture about 14 f-stops of light, which means that the cameras are entirely capable of creating a high dynamic range video signal. That is a large spectrum of light, and that is all being crunched down to fit our old standards, regular standard dynamic range. So it could be really cool because, again, this is going to be up to NASA. You know, there's the part of it which is how it was shot, and then there's how it's actually mastered and what format it's put into, and then how it's displayed. But as far as what was actually originally shot by those 4K cameras, there could be some spectacular high dynamic range content on it as well.
Yeah, especially in space, right? I mean, that bright objects in the middle of a black background,
it doesn't get
exactly
much blacker than outer space.
Yeah, it's perfect.
That is a black background, yeah. So, you know, that I'm really hoping that NASA will take the time to do that with this footage, because the raw footage itself has the information in there. So it's nice that this is sort of coinciding with, okay, it's not just the higher resolution, it's not just the greater number of pixels. Now we do have these standards. So if they so choose, they could put it into a high dynamic range format and we'd be able to get that really spectacular contrast that they'd be shooting out there. I'm excited to see that if they do it. So I'm really hoping they do.
Yeah, and it says it will be available from some certain television providers is from the article. So it looks like that will be out there somewhere. And it also says that you'll have to have at least 13 megabits of internet, which is quite a bit.
Yeah.
You know, it's probably quite common amongst geeks to have a higher higher plan of internet that has that kind of bandwidth, but amongst normal people out there, probably not so much.
I got to tell you, looking at that figure makes me think that it's just more pixels. Because if it actually were containing a wider gamut of colors and a high dynamic range signal and perhaps a higher frame rate as well, because I think they said
it would be more
shooting it at 60 frames. It would actually be more. Yeah, it would be considerably higher than only 13 megabits per second. So.
They're calling it 4K 60 frames second.
Okay, yeah, that's the more frames, that's a lot of data.
Yeah.
All of a sudden, you know, when it's only 24 frames a second, it's that saves you, you know, almost two-thirds of your data right there just on the frames.
Well, you know,
we're
on the cusp of getting 10 gigabit LAN, right? So we can handle that kind of stuff.
Yeah, I think actually where this might end up being most valuable is not right away. I think it's the fact the raw footage is being is being shot and archived
for later.
Because once you go back and possibly remaster that and release it again, that's when things could look really spectacular. And they're mentioning that in the article, that part of it is not just new footage. They want to go back to some of the old footage that they had as well, some of which was shot on film, of course.
Yeah, which is fine.
Yeah, so once you scan that back in at a really high resolution, you get all the detail. And again, you know, film way back when had a higher dynamic range than what the displays could actually play back. So rescanning it all now with these new capabilities that we have, we could get some very spectacular stuff that was a lot older. It's going to be the stuff that was shot on video that there's no way to really make that look any better.
It's
kind of stuck where it is.
It's right, exactly. It's stuck exactly where it is, and it's always funny, you know. Film is like the ultimate resolution. It's like It's almost like the pixels are the size of the chemicals that were on the film.
There
in the
are
first
no
place.
Pixels on film. Yeah,
well, exactly.
It was never divided up into little squares.
So all right, so I think that'll do it for this week. Rob, I want to thank you for coming on. This has been fascinating. I've loved every minute of it. And how do people hear more of this? Is there some place they could go where they could possibly hear more of this information?
Well, first of all, thanks so much for having me. It was a lot of fun. I'm hoping that end-user listeners will enjoy the show and find something possibly useful or at least entertaining in there. But yeah, absolutely. I've peppered it throughout the show, but of course it is avrant.com. That's the primary website to come. When we do our show, when we do the AV Rant podcast, we mention links and videos and all that type of stuff, and that's where it gets posted, is on the website. For getting in touch with me, you can just type in rob@avrant.com to your email, and that'll reach me. If you want to actually have a question on AV Rant the show, just send that to question@avrant.com, and that will go to our producer, who fields all the questions and puts them together nicely for us. And my co-host, of course, is Tom. It's actually his show. I don't want to like take any ownership. I can go away, he can't. AV Rant doesn't exist if Tom goes away. It exists if I go away. But he's just tom@avrant.com. So those are all our email addresses. I'm @FirstReflect on Twitter. And AV Rant, of course, is on Facebook, too. That's facebook.com/AV Rant Podcast. It's all one word together like that.
So I highly recommend that people go and give whatever podcast source you use to listen to things. You should go give a listen to AV Rant and give them some stars. That's definitely what you want to do.
That would be much appreciated. Yes.
And while you're there, you can give us some stars, too. It's good stuff. Leave us a review, please. So I am also on the internet. I know you're shocked by this. I am @ChrisHaleBarnes on Twitter. That's probably the easiest way. And we've got an email for feedback for the podcast. It's theenduser@thedigitalmediazone.com. It's THENDUSR. So anyway, it is time to get out of here. So thank you, everyone, for listening to the show. And, of course, you can find more information, including links in the show notes of everything we talked about in this episode. And that's over at thedigitalmediazone.com under the end user. It's THENDUSR. The DMZ also has a few other podcasts you can have a listen to. You can have a listen to Entertainment 2.0 and Home On. You can also send us some feedback. As I mentioned, we've got our email. It's theenduser@thedigitalmediazone.com. And we've got a joint Twitter account of @theenduser. So you can join us in the chat room as we record the show live every Wednesday night at 9 p.m. Eastern Time. I am your host and producer, Chris Barnes.
And I'm Rob H.
And thanks for coming out, Rob. We will see you next week, folks. Bye-bye.